I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear a replay of Michael Parenti's speech given in May of 2010 at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California. He's talking about conspiracies, and that'll be followed by details of upcoming events. So let's begin with Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an internationally known award-winning author and lecturer. He is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. And three of his most recent books that he's written are God and His Demons, Contrary Notions, A Michael Parenti Reader, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And here he is speaking at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz on May 15th, 2010.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I'm actually going to give a talk about deep ideology and conspiracy is really what I'm going to be talking about. And there's another talk I gave about conspiracy. They just rediscovered it. It had been lost for some years, and they found the tape of it. Some student had actually taped it. It's not such bad shape, and it's available on TUC Radio, and that's called Conspiracy and Class Power. And that talk is probably more coherent and intelligent than this one will be because I was younger and more capable then. It's about 12 years old or so. I just heard it the other night. I said, hey, whoa, that's pretty good. And I thought I'd try to smuggle it in here, but, you know, it's better to really to think anew and think about some other things again. But what do I mean by deep ideology? Well, I mean I want to try and fit it into the theme of this conference. But it is questionable because ideology is usually something that is out there. It's vigorously propagated. You know, you talk of the conservative ideology has talked about the free market. They talked about how government can't solve the problem. Government is the problem. We're overregulated. We're overtaxed. There's a downward distribution to the less worthy. And now money is wasted by government bureaucrats and the like. But behind this explicit ideological cell, I just gave you a sketch of what the right-wing dicta are on that. Behind that explicit ideological cell is an implicit ideological goal and rationale. A rationale that's really around very real interests. In 1978, I came across a quote by somebody from the Business Council. His name wasn't given, but he was saying things like, what's going on? The income gap between the highest and lowest is more narrow than it's ever been. Human services are increasing. If we will end up as a social democracy if we don't watch it, he said. Now, I found that very fascinating because I think there's only about 600 people in all of America who know what the hell social democracy means or even use the term. I mean, the term is simply not used in America, and that's a victory right there. The ability to keep certain words out of political discourse, like social democracy, is a very real right-wing victory. The ability to inject certain words like conspiracy theory, which puts a closure on any kind of thinking about something, that also is a tremendous victory. So this struggle, this battle over words, is something to be taken very seriously. And if anybody asks me tomorrow on that panel, what will you do? I'll say struggle and battle over words. This was in 1978, when this guy from the Business Council made that statement that we're heading for social democracy. What he meant is we're going to become another Denmark or Sweden or Norway, where people will have health care, where the standard of living is going to be very good and high, where there's going to be a real pressure on the super rich, where CEOs will not be able to make hundreds of millions of dollars every year. They're going to have to get along on just a few million a year. You know, how the hell can a guy like that live on a few million a year? So they don't want that. And 78 was a very significant year because that business council delivered the word to President Jimmy Carter. And we got Reaganism, and we got Reagan 2 years before Reagan. He didn't come into office till January 81. And in 78, end of 78, Carter was acting like Reagan. He started cutting back on human services. He called for increase in the military budget. He was moving in a rightward direction. But Carter couldn't really do the thing that they wanted, which was a massive rollback. Carter was still beholden to the labor unions, to black voters, to progressives, liberals, and those people. And so they went with Reagan. Now, fast forward 30 years. You have had in that 30 years an ideological war that these guys have waged. They understand something that the liberals still don't understand. They understand something in the Republican Party that the Democrats still haven't been able to grasp, because the Democrats are too busy saying, we don't disagree that much. We really can work together. We can be bipartisan. They understand that ideas count, that ideology counts, that the words you use count, that those words control those ideas, and those ideas control those people. And they have been hammering home for those 30 years. So you go 30 years forward to the year 2008, and David Frum, GOP strategist, quote, the core task that the Republican Party has had was to stop and reverse to some degree the drift of democratic countries after the Second World War towards social democracy. And that is what we did in the U.S. We stopped the drift toward, and there's those two words that jumped right back up out of the page at me. It was in the New Yorker magazine. Social democracy. We got to stop the drift towards social democracy. These guys know about social democracy, and they know they have a conscious agenda to prevent it from happening. And they know that their opponents aren't even paying attention to this. The average Democratic politician, from Pat Leahy to Schumer to the others, with the possible exception of Howard Dean, who does know how to organize nationally and is totally ignored by the Democratic National Council. The others are all worrying about getting reelected themselves and putting in their little plea and talking about this or that issue. Well, what was Frum saying? He was saying, we've won the battle. We have so rolled back the social democracy that we've run out of issues. Furthermore, we've moved successfully so far right, we've moved beyond our base. And he noticed in the 2006 election, what? The Republicans lost Congress. And where did they lose Congress? They lost it in the goddamn Republican suburbs that always voted for them. Those people started waking up. Those people were saying, hey, they've been jacking us up the kazoo for all these years, and it's getting a little too bad. What are we getting out of this? I think I'm going to go back and start voting Democratic again. And domestic issues showed, and the polls showed, that the general public was on the liberal side of most of these issues. They were for human services. They were for keeping and developing Social Security. They were for health care and education and environmental protections and taxing the super rich. But as I said, the liberals never really mobilized that, never really built a narrative and a deep ideology and a public ideology around those issues, because some of these liberals are too busy not being liberals and being conservatives. Oh, we got a president who's like that. He's happiest when he can say, I'm for nuclear power, and we're going to drill offshore because America's going to be self-sustaining. Remember, he talked about he was a drill baby drill without the baby, but there he was. Those 40 years or so, the conservatives not only fashioned a mainline ideology, they built a net of media commentators, publications, networks, as I said, media networks, think tanks, professional and academic associations of their own, training centers that would channel and recruit and channel cadres of young conservative activists into law schools and from law schools into clerking for judgeships and the like, teachers, writers who promoted conservative ideas and policies. So there has been this structure of organizations that has orchestrated and propagated a mass line ideology that has been guided by a deep ideology, that is the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class. Sometimes it peeks through in the mass line ideology, when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism and progressive income tax is equated, and inheritance tax on the rich is equated with confiscation and communist theft, you know. The right over the last 40 years or more has been really pushing this line. Now, what I'm saying here is that this is a conscious, intentionally disguised agenda by people who know what social democracy is and say to you explicitly in English, your mother tongue, they say, we want to destroy social democracy. We don't want that in this country or any country. So they've got this, and they mobilize broad constituencies on behalf of the interests of the few. And that's the point to remember. A book I wrote on this called Democracy for the Few now just come out in its 9th edition. Don't buy it. It's horrible. They sell it as a textbook for $70, $80, despite protests of the author. That's not what the book was intended to be, a book only for royalty or oppressed students, you know. But for the few, you see, the very few at the top, and that's an idea that is at the heart of their raison d'être. That's an idea that they dare not utter to anybody. You'll never hear them saying that on the air. You'll never hear Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh saying, all of this is for the interests of the very super rich. Everything I do, everyone I serve is for that. Epauchi is what they were called in ancient Rome, in the late Republic. And the term used quite often by one of them who was a member of the Epauchi. I wrote a book called The Assassination of Julius Caesar and dealt with this. They were called the Optimati. They were the inner core of the Roman Senate. The Roman Senate had 500 members, but there were these 15, 20, 30 who really, really owned much of Rome. And Epauchi was the term used by Cicero, who many people would consider one of them. He really wasn't. He didn't have the right blood, but he was their faithful servant and their faithful spokesperson. Pauci in Latin means few. He was saying, the few. This is for the few, you know. And sometimes he would be a little sarcastic about it and all. So we don't say Epauchi. We say the super rich, the less than one half of 1% who really own most of the wealth. Now, whenever you ascribe conscious intent and pursuit of self-interest at the top, you'll hear someone say, well, what are you, a conspiracy theorist? You can say farmers consciously organized to pursue their interests, and everybody will say, uh-huh, the farmers are organized. You can say machinists or auto workers are organizing, and everybody says, uh-huh. They're consciously organizing and pursuing, or school teachers or other people. But if you say that the people who own most of America and most of the world, if you say they consciously organize and pursue things to get what they want, then you hear people saying, oh, you have a conspiracy theory? You think they really do that? The alternative to a conspiracy theory is an innocence theory. That is, they do all this stuff, but they're not pursuing self-interest. They just do it, you know. The other alternative is a somnambulist theory. Somnambulism is the tendency to walk in your sleep. David Rockefeller gets up in the morning and he says, what am I going to do to advance my interests and protect my interests? No, that would be conspiratorial. Hey, well, that stuff happens, whatever. That's okay. Another alternative would be coincidence theory. It's just a coincidence that this happened. Or sometimes a variation of coincidence theory is uncanny theory. Then there's stupidity theory and incompetence theory. Don't laugh at that one. That's used all the time. I have had about a 20-year argument with my co-politicists on the left to stop calling Ronald Reagan stupid, to stop calling George Bush stupid. It's good for a joke or something, but that guy knew what he was doing, and he did it. He got rid of the inheritance tax for the super rich. He cut corporate taxes down to almost nothing. He doubled the military budget. He waged two major wars and got this country into war and left it that way. He deregulated, another creep before him named Bill Clinton deregulated the banking system and all that to create this disaster that we've been facing. These guys know what they're doing, and they know who they're doing it for. They're doing it for themselves. But they will actually even use, they'll even use this idea of incompetence theory to save their asses. When Reagan was on the line and brought before that court because of Iran-Contra, after Poindexter fell on the sword for him and said, oh, no, the president didn't know. Yeah, like they were going to do this whole scheme, these billions of dollars down to the Contras, conniving with Iran and all this. They're going to do this without telling the president, without clearing it with him. Cabinet-level people are going to just do this. Of course. And then Weinberger and all these others. It turns out Reagan knew all about it. Reagan was the guy who okayed it. And Reagan's defense was incompetence theory, saying, you know, I just really got to get a better grasp on what's going on here. I should be more hands-on. And everybody going, oh, Ronnie, what a dumb dodo. He didn't know. All right, he doesn't go to jail. All right. So then there's also stochastic theory. Stochasticism among intellectual academic circles, which is filled with people who have too much time on their hands. They make up words like stochasticism. It means everything happening by random. There's really no causality as such. So, you know, stuff just happens. So history is just these eventualities that just tumble down on top of each other like that. And stochasticism theory has a use. I mean, there are times when such things happen that you could have a very rational causality of people settling in a valley, let's say, because the land is fertile, the water is good and all that. And so you got one set of causalities, and then you have the mountain on the side, and that has a geological strata, and that has another set, and then one day the mountain comes down and crashes down and kills the people. The mountain didn't intend to kill the people. And that would be a stochastic happening where two eventualities quite accidentally collide and hit each other. So there is in history both causality and accident. We're not saying there aren't accidents at times, but is everything an accident when it comes from the top down? Well, the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class sometimes peeks through in the mass line ideology when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism. Oh, I already told you that. Let me go on. It's reached the point now on conspiracy where it has become one of those requisite genuflection renunciations hardened by convention. That is where you have to deny it. You have to disassociate yourself. You have to be saying something. Let me give you an analogy. It's very much like in the 1980s when you had the requisite genuflection was to make an anti-Soviet comment. I can think of leading progressive writers who could not criticize U.S. foreign policy without saying, and if we do that, we'll be as bad as the Soviets in Afghanistan. Every third paragraph or so, there had to be a sideswipe, and you had to flash a sign. And I would say to one or two of them, why don't you just wear a big sign saying, I am an anti-communist? That's fine. And then once you hold it up, we'll all agree. And you don't have to keep making these genuflections. I can remember a colleague of mine, when I was back at a postdoctoral at Yale, doing this, or at Yale, the guy who's already, I said, Bill, you know, you got tenure. You got to keep flashing your anti-communist, anti-Soviet card. He was talking about policy in Africa and this and that, and there were all sorts of other things we could say. So that kind of hardened genuflection, it's a concept that is demonized, and it's needed. Let me give you an example. Walter Karp, and it hurts me to take Walter because he was a wonderful guy. He's dead now. He wrote a book called Indispensable Enemies, 1974. He writes as follows. When it can be established, and he's writing about conspiracy, when it can be established that a number of political acts work in concert to produce a certain result, the presumption is strong that the actors were aiming at the result in question. Yes. When it can be shown, in addition, that the actors have an interest in producing these results, the presumptions become a fair certainty. And then he says, no conspiracy theory is required. You see, he has to disassociate. He's making a very intelligent conspiracy analysis, but he's got to disassociate and he's got to genuflect himself by saying, I'm not making a conspiracy theory here. No conspiracy theory is required. That's right, no conspiracy theory. A conspiracy analysis is being made, and you just made it. I'll tell you more, he says, because it's really good. He says, on the other hand, those who make blanket condemnations of conspiracy theories base their own view on a far-fetched theory indeed, namely that whatever those in high office actually do, they are essentially men of goodwill. So you have those people who say there can't be such conspiracies because our leaders are people of goodwill. They have good intentions, and that's the way they are. I'll return to that point later. According to this school of special pleading, the king can do no wrong doctrine, suitably updated, it is entirely proper to praise an American president for skillfully engineering some desirable result. But to ascribe to him the same skillful engineering of an indefensible one is to fall victim to political paranoia and conspiratorial fetishism. I mean, that's not, Karp doesn't believe that. He's saying that's the way these people think, that when the president does something craftily and cleverly and succeeds and wins a victory, everybody says, oh, that was good political leadership. That's what that was. But if you say he would use craft and guile and skill to perpetrate unsavory ends like starting a war of aggression, then that's conspiracy theory that you're having. And there are these other two words. He mentioned one of the other two words. You see it in the press regularly. If they don't say you're suffering from conspiracy theory, they'll say you're being paranoid or you're being cynical. The cynical view, that's the other term that's sometimes used. So what we're facing, and not only from mainstream media and conventional academics, but even from among some leading progressive writers, we're facing a knee-jerk resistance to ascribing intent or covert actions and such by dismissing such ascriptions as conspiracy theory. So the term conspiracy theory is used to dismiss, one, the idea of a conscious design by policymakers. Two, a hidden but knowing intent. Three, a secret plan. Four, a secret interest. The term conspiracy theory is applied in two dimensions. The first dimension focuses on specific actions and events: an assassination, an act of terrorism, a mysterious disappearance of giant skyscrapers, a dirty deal in business, which is an illegal one. Or the second ascription is to dismiss an entire class interest, an entire social and ideological agenda. That rulers do not rule from secret intent. Do you get the difference? I mean, one is about specific actions and the other is about the whole system and structure. This explains why somebody, say like Noam Chomsky, who does very good and very valuable work, this is not to take away anything from him in other areas, but I've had differences with him over the JFK assassination. Noam Chomsky, Alexander Coburn, Chip Berlet, they denounce this conspiracy theory and they say if you're a radical, you don't go looking at these little hokey-pokey secret plots. Most of them imagined, even a few might be real, so what? Because there's the larger, bigger picture you got to look at. He's surprised, and they are surprised to find out, that they themselves are thought of as conspiracy theorists. There are people who think Noam Chomsky is a conspiracy theorist because of that second use of the term, that is, using it to mean a whole class power systemic intent that's directed toward certain kinds of forces. Behind the left rejection of the concept of conspiracy theory in academic circles is this structuralist functionalist debate that's gone on. Many of you have not heard about this structuralist functionalist debate over the years. You have every reason to be grateful that you haven't. It shows that you haven't been wasting your goddamn time on this issue. Well, the debate goes something like this. If you try to explain things through incidental or idiosyncratic analysis, this is very poor analysis, you know? If you try to say, well, the Spanish-American War happened because McKinley was all sort of scared and weak and Teddy Roosevelt was a real bombastic, and these personalities of the actors, and that brought the war on, or King Louis, who was it? King Louis says, no, it wouldn't be, King Louis says, gave aid to the American revolutionaries because, I forget, somebody killed his pet cat and he got angry at the guy and so forth, and somebody, you know, little incidentalist stories like this, or personalities and such, that is a very limited and dubious analysis of trying to explain historical phenomena. That the more impersonal and the more systemic, then the more radical. And the more systemic, the less volitional. The broader is the scope when you have a systemic analysis, and the deeper is the depth of your analysis, it is assumed. But what they're assuming here, you see, is a conflict between structural factors and functional factors, volitional factors, where people are consciously acting as actors with conscious intent. Because, in fact, the structure plays itself out through volitional forces. You have to have volitional forces. The CIA is itself... Neither is the CIA structuralist or is it functionalist. Functionalist, in other words, functionalist is discarded. Conspiracy theory is discarded as a form of functionalism. And Michael Abbott and Noam Chomsky had an article on that in Z Magazine. They call themselves structuralists, that they have structural. And I had a contract on a book I was writing at the time, Against Empire, with, what was that, the publishing house in Maine, the Common Courage. He didn't want to go on with the project. I canceled it with him, and I switched it over to City Lights as my publisher. And he said on the phone, this was after I had written that thing on JFK assassination, he said, well, you're a functionalist, and I'm a structuralist. You know, and I had other words for what he was and what I was, sounding something like structuralist and functionalist. And I'm saying, what is wrong with these guys? They suffer from the... See, in academia, academics are never happier than when they can choose up sides and they can dichotomize an issue. Well, you're a structuralist, I'm a functionalist. Or you're a something otherist and I'm a this-ist. And then they choose up and they start fighting and they have a little... You're a behavioralist and I'm a intentionalist. Or you're a this and this and I'm a that-a-list. That's when they're really happy. And, of course, most of the time, these things aren't mutually exclusive. These functions play out. The CIA, as I started to say, the CIA is a structured conspiracy operation. You know, you could say, is the CIA a systemic agency that's part of a whole overriding class interest that must mobilize power in a certain way and does these things and operates that way? Or is it a bunch of conspirators who are doing that? And there are those of us who say, why can't it be both? Doesn't A and B, don't A and B serve each other perfectly well? But as I say, if you're so busy choosing up sides to keep yourself busy, they have too much time on their hands. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. Did you get that down? That's a direct quote from Michael Parenti. Okay. I should have read it more slowly. I see some of you were fumbling for pens. Oh, you want me to read it again? All right. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. I don't even know what that means, but that sounds like this.
You've just been listening to a speech by Michael Parenti at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California on May 15th, 2010. Tune in next week to hear the final part of that speech. You can also catch the video of the speech at the website understandingdeeppolitics.org. And now for the upcoming events. The 12th anniversary of 9/11 is fast approaching. There'll be a national conference in Washington, D.C. on September 14th and 15th. To learn more about this great event and to learn how you can get tickets, the website is www.dc911conference.org. So that's dc911conference.org. We'll also be showing a movie on September 11th at the University of Hartford, and I'll have more details on that in upcoming broadcasts. And the architects and engineers are working on a project called Rethink 9/11. To learn more about this and to learn how you can support them, go to ae911truth.org or to rethink911.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.